which was forbidden. The Americans claimed this was due to psychological manipulation, and the CIA took advantage of this godsend to obtain budgets that allowed them to work on brainwashing.
During the Korean War, the American pilots who were captured started making apparently false confessions of germ warfare. The first question is, was it really false confessions? But then when they were brought back to the United States, the military and the military psychiatrists studied them and decided that there's mind control operations being run against Americans. So for defensive purposes, we had to study this, figure it out. Therefore, we created MKUltra. Before MKUltra was Bluebird and Artichoke. So the whole rationale is it's defensive. It's because of what the communists are doing. Problem is, the Korean War started in June 1950, and Bluebird was signed into operation by the head of the CIA in April 1950.
In the Edgewood camp where James Ketchum worked, soldiers are called upon more and more. They think they're testing gas masks. In reality, the canisters are filled with a toxic chemical.
They were testing a whole assortment of different hallucinogens like LSD and marijuana and things like that. And they explored other drugs, very high levels of atropine, scopolamine, benzolates, very powerful. And a lot of these soldiers ended up incapacitated. It took them a long time to recover. And while they're in recovery, the doctors cannot do any more experiments because it's basically a very small base and testing operation. In other words, they needed a new site.
It's in this context of the Cold War and secret agents that on the 16th of August, 1951, the tragedy at Pont Saint-Esprit unfolded. France was suffering economically, and the Americans distrusted this ally they couldn't control. The village was under the control of socialists at the time. In the eyes of America, they were Reds, the epitome of the Soviet danger. But the mayor, Roger Castillon, doesn't believe in a foreign conspiracy. Yet American experts like Colin Ross are much more down to earth.
Obviously, that compound didn't just come in the rain, or just wasn't sitting around naturally. It was obviously organized, controlled, distributed. So whether it was actually LSD or some other compound doesn't make that much difference. Pont Saint-Esprit is actually not just this happened once in the world in a village in France. It's consistent with all the other experiments on the public that have done in the United States and done for a documented fact.
To achieve their goals, would the Americans be prepared to use a whole village as a laboratory? After all, these are civilians, not trained soldiers. However, in September 1950, nearly 1 year before Pont Saint-Esprit, this is exactly what they did, and in their own country. Off the coast of San Francisco, the American Marines were carrying out military maneuvers. A ship approached the coast and bombarded the city with a bacteria causing nucosomia, Serratia marcescens. The military were testing the effects of spraying this through the air. This classified secret defense map shows the scale of the targeted area. At least 11 people were hospitalized, one of whom died of pneumonia. The villagers wonder why a supposedly festive drug that is loved by hippies would have had such terrifying effects at Pont Saint-Esprit. James Ketchum, the military psychiatrist who specialized in LSD, a little reluctantly, admits that the drug is scary for those who take it unknowingly.
Some individuals could have a bad trip if someone gave them LSD and didn't tell them about it. That's very anxiety-producing. Or if they were inexperienced and not particularly well-balanced themselves, took a fairly large dose of LSD, they could have a bad trip. How would you feel if you had a cup of coffee and started to see things going like this or like this, or brilliant colors appear on the ceiling, or suddenly you felt you're out of your body and looking down on yourself. These are all things that can happen with LSD.
But can these effects have a delayed onset? In Pensant Esprit, the older generation remember the night of the apocalypse, where dozens of men went mad and were sectioned in a psychiatric unit because of terrifying visions. This night took place more than 2 weeks after the cursed bread was consumed. But again, James Ketchum admits that it's possible.
Some individuals had flashbacks later in which they would go into a situation where they had been when they were taking LSD and have a flood of the same emotions and some of them anxiety producing.
In 1951, French investigators also consider LSD and call upon Albert Hoffman, inventor of the drug. On the spot, he tells the investigators that he has no doubt that the hallucinations were due to LSD. But after returning to Switzerland, he backtracks, claiming he was mistaken. The French want explanations, but public health documents from 1951 show that the expert became suddenly unreachable. We are sorry that the eminent professor has not been able to get back in touch with us.
I would think if the Sandoz scientists are saying it doesn't seem to be LSD, they're just trying to cover up the fact that it's 100% for sure that LSD must have come from Sandoz, because they were the only suppliers. It's nothing more than a cover-up.
After months of inquiry, the French investigators were so disoriented by the number of fruitless leads that the incident at Pont Saint-Esprit falls victim to its own mystery. During this time, the experiments continued in the United States, and they reached a level never seen before in any country, including the Soviet bloc. IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Data collected by Tianwen-1 mission and Zhurong Mars rover are offering insights into a previously unexplored region of Mars' northern hemisphere. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Smriti Malapati, writer. This article is published under the heading, China's Mars rover has amassed rings of novel geological data. Stay tuned for more. more than 30 scientists across mainland China, Hong Kong, and Macau are rushing to process data collected by China's Mars rover, Zhurong, and by the nation's Tianwen-1 spacecraft, which is in orbit around the planet. Several studies have trickled out, but researchers say that more are coming in the next weeks and months, offering insights on the climate, geology, and history of Mars' northern hemisphere. Since September, the National Astronomical Observatories of the Chinese Academy of Sciences, NAOC, which has been receiving the data from space, has released nearly 200 gigabytes of information that was collected from 8 instruments on the rover, an orbiter, between February and June. These instruments include cameras, a radar system, climate sensors, and a laser spectrometer. Some surface features, such as possible sedimentary material and potential mud volcanoes, hint at the historic flow of water, so scientists are looking for any clues that there was once water or ice below the surface. This is of great scientific interest, as it might provide evidence of an ancient ocean, says Bo Wu, a planetary scientist at the Hong Kong Polytechnic University, who is analyzing some of the data. Tianwen-1 arrived at Mars in February. In May, it dropped a lander containing Zhurong onto a vast basin known as Utopia Plancha. The rover's initial mission was intended to be only about 3 months long, but it has exceeded expectations. Over a period of 4 months, the rover traveled more than 1,000 meters, visiting features of interest and even investigating part of the capsule that brought it to the surface, along with the remains of the descent parachute. In September, Zhurong was powered down into hibernation by the China National Space Administration, CNSA, because Mars had passed behind the Sun relative to Earth, meaning that communication was lost. However, in October, it was powered up again and has traversed another 200 meters in the direction of what may once have been the coastline of an ancient ocean. The month-long break offered mission scientists at research institutes across China a chance to start analyzing data. Some researchers had already received images of Mars from orbiter's cameras in March, and the CNSA had previously shared with the public images and videos taken by the rover during its descent and from the surface. But now researchers are studying the much larger volume of data released in September. This data set includes images from Zhurong's navigation camera, climatic data on temperature, pressure, and wind speed, information on the chemical composition of rocks, soil, sand dunes from a laser spectrometer, and clues from below the surface from its ground-penetrating radar. Apart from the handful of images and videos released by the CNSA, few scientific insights about the mission have been released or published until now. Researchers say this is because it has taken time to process and clean up the data. Doing this ensures that the data are reliable and removes noise produced by the instruments, says Lu Pan, a planetary scientist at the University of Copenhagen. The fact that this mission is China's first to the surface of another planet might also have slowed things down compared with NASA's recent Mars missions. She says, if this is the first time you do it, there is a learning process. David Flannery, an astrobiologist at Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane, Australia, who is in communication with scientists in China, says that the team's approach to managing data could also have contributed to the delay in releasing new insights. With NASA's Perseverance mission, which Flannery is involved in each instrument on the rover is designed by a different team which has exclusive access to data from that instrument for a few months before it becomes available to all. But under the CNSA model, the data generated for all the instruments on the Zhurong and Tianwen-1 are processed by the NAOC before making the information available to multiple teams of scientists linked to the mission. Two publications have already emerged. One study posted as a preprint in late September analyzed images and information friction that were gleaned from the movement of Zhurong's wheel. The results show that regions of Mars that the rover trundled over have properties similar to those of compact sandy soil on Earth. The study provides useful data about surface soil properties, says Xiao Long, a planetary geologist at the China University of Geosciences in Wuhan. This might be helpful for understanding how soil and dust on the surface formed, says Long, who is also conducting his own analysis. A second study published in August used high-resolution images from the orbiter to pinpoint the rover's precise coordinates on Mars, but researchers say that many more studies are expected soon, including some on the region's topography. So far, the data has been shared only with researchers directly involved with the mission, but Wu says the NAOC will at some point release them to the public and the international community. That could help to speed up the analysis. Scientists with more experience of Mars might be able to recognize features of interest and their significance more quickly, says Flannery. Mars is peculiar in some ways, and geologists are only as good as the rocks they have seen in the past, he adds. Zhurong will now continue to explore potentially for years, as some of NASA's Mars rover have. Tianwen-1 has also been busy. The spacecraft recently adjusted its orbit and switched from acting mainly as a communications relay between Zhurong and Earth to also conducting its own observations of Mars. Wen's five planetary scientists at Peking University Beijing, who is analyzing Zhurong's radar data, says that on November 11th, the CNSA deployed and began to test antenna for the orbiter's radar. Also earlier this month, the CNSA and the European Space Agency trialed whether the ESA Mars Express orbiter could be used to relay Zhurong's data to Earth. An exercise that Pan says is an amazing step towards increased international collaboration with China. As Zhurong resumes its journey, Bo says that he and his team are providing suggestions for future data collection that take in surface features of particular scientific interest.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The family of Agnes Wanjiru, a young Kenyan mother murdered by British troops almost a decade ago, is now filing charges to demand answers over her death. The brother-in-law of the murdered Kenyan woman speaks here about his pain and suffering.
Nine British soldiers joked about her death on social media several years later. The family now hope this fresh investigation will give them the answers they so desperately need.
I feel a lot of pain when I remember Agnes. We brought her up well, and just as she was settling down, her life was taken away, leaving us to fend for her young child. It's my hope that this child will get justice.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on the reopening of the file of a young Kenyan woman brutally murdered by British troops training in central Kenya in 2012. Kenyan members of parliament now say they are having attempts to cover up the murder. In the second part of our program, we shall look at the exaggerated reports of the return of some African artifacts looted by Western countries, especially France. The question many are asking is this: are Western countries willing to return every single artifact they stole from Africa?
Kenyan woman murdered by British troops. The body of 21-year-old Kenyan woman Agnes Wanjiru was found in 2012 after she went out partying with British troops at a hotel in the central Kenyan town of Nanyuku, where the British Army has a permanent garrison. Last October, one of the troops involved confessed to killing Wanjiru, and now the family of the murdered woman is demanding for justice. The governor of Kenya's Laikipia County, where the murder took place, says the crime brings back memories of atrocities committed by Britain during the colonial rule.
The revelations have reignited calls for an independent investigation and justice for Wanjiru. Kenyan authorities have announced that they are reopening the case. The sister of the murdered Kenyan is emotional over the revival of the murder file.
Recently, when the media started airing the story, it opened old wounds. It's like Agnes has just died. It has even affected her daughter, but we had to let her know what is going on. I pray that God grants the British government the wisdom to handle this case well. When I think of Agnes, I remember how happy she was. She loved to sing. She taught my youngest daughter how to sing. The person who killed Agnes should face the law, because the child who was orphaned has suffered a lot. Bearing in mind she was just 5 months old, even feeding at that time was difficult.
Well, for more on this murder file involving British troops in Kenya, my colleague contacted Patrick Gathara, a writer and political cartoonist. He's also the curator of the Kenya news website, The Elephant. Now, Mr. Gathara first explains here on why it has taken almost 10 years for this case to come back to limelight.
The case of Agnes Wanjiru has taken so long simply because she was killed initially by allegedly by the British soldiers, she was missing for about 2 months before her body was actually recovered from a septic tank. And by the time she was found, her body was found, the soldiers had already left the country. And then that was the initial delay. Then there was also sort of quite a bit of delay in setting up an inquiry that then decided that the British soldiers were most likely responsible for her death. And in addition to that, there was quite a lot of laxity in terms of both governments in following up the case.
Well, the Defense and Foreign Relations Committee in Kenya's parliament has raised concerns that the authorities could be engaged in cover-up, hence delay in Agnes Wanjiru's murder case.
It's a scandal of a cover-up. It's purely because the junior officers reported to their seniors, and their seniors never took necessary action.
We asked Mr. Gathara to give us his take on why Britain's Ministry of Defense deliberately refused to investigate the brutal murder of Wanjiru in 2012 amid reports of a plot to cover up this heinous crime.
There was a deliberate attempt to cover it up, or at least to there was some hope that it would go away. I think we have seen in Kenya quite a number of cases involving British and even American soldiers and sailors, where they have come and committed crimes here, killed people, killed animals, started fires, and stuff, and then kind of disappeared. So when they go away and we don't really see justice done, we don't see them being pursued, either by our own authorities here in Kenya or by the British or American authorities. So this is not a new thing, it's not the first time, and we need to keep in mind that there has been, since colonial days, a pattern where atrocities committed against locals are treated as if they are not very serious, and there is a tendency to sweep them under the rug.
Allegations against British troops serving in Kenya and elsewhere around the world have dogged the British government and military.
The UK has nothing to hide here. We want these investigations to be dealt with as quickly as possible. We want those responsible to be brought to justice.
Considering the foregoing, many are now wondering if there are any prospects for justice in this case, particularly considering the fact that British troops walked away scot-free after committing horrendous crimes in Kenya and elsewhere in the world. So, are the prospects quite slim?
I think the prospects are still quite slim. And again, it depends on what you define as justice. Right now, there is lots of talk of getting the soldiers extradited to Kenya to stand trial here. But the fact that you're seeing the names of the soldiers are still being kept secret, we still don't know who they are, the people who are to be extradited, means that it's quite questionable whether there is a lot of will to pursue this in a serious way. The other thing to think about is that given the time lag that we've had, more than 10 years, is the evidence still there to hold them guilty and to hold them accountable for this? So I think there's quite a lot of questions as to whether we can really secure a guilty verdict. And even if we were to get a guilty verdict, what would be the punishment? What would be a requisite punishment? Would they be, for example, jailed in Kenya, in Kenyan prisons? Or would we have a situation where they are sentenced here and then sent to prison in the UK.
Now, Kenyan members of parliament have threatened to reject a renewed military agreement signed recently between the country and Britain unless suspects in the killing of Agnes Wanjiru are extradited and prosecuted according to Kenyan laws.
So until we have concrete evidence to suggest that the Kenya government is looking into this matter and the culprit actually being brought back to Kenya to face our criminal justice system, then there's a time now we can probably append our signatures.
Now, Mr. Gathara speaks here about this military deal now that members of parliament in Kenya have threatened to shoot it down.
Well, I think it's a good question. I mean, why should we be giving British soldiers space to come in and do their military exercises here? Why don't they do them back at home? You know, and also, as you mentioned, given the fact that we have these sorts of conflicts between locals and the troops, we know, like, for example, there was a big issue about unexploded munitions being left lying around and people stepping on them or handling them and ending up getting injured. You know, and there was a court case and some compensation that was ordered paid. But it is still an issue. You know, why should we be allowing it? This is 60 years after independence. What are these deals about? And it's really important to remember that these are not agreements that the ordinary citizens are involved in. You know, they are really government-to-government ones. They take really very little account of whether or not the local population wants this this military people here, you know. So I think for me it's quite problematic. I think I see no reason and no justification for continuing to host foreign military people on our soil, especially when our people are having to pay such a high price for it.
Kenya's Defense Cabinet Secretary has acknowledged that justice has been delayed for the woman murdered by British troops, but has promised to ensure justice is served.
Indeed, justice has been delayed for Agnes Wanjiru and her young child, but it must not be denied. We must do everything to ensure, invoking the powers provided under the Defense Cooperation Agreement, to ensure that that is done.
The crimes committed by British troops in Kenya have gone unpunished, contrary to the agreement between the two countries. Some people believe this level of impunity by the British military is historical.
Historically, there has been a sense of impunity. I mean, if you go back 60 years to the Mau Mau conflict in the 1950s, we have till today people who are still alive who committed terrible atrocities against the local population. You know, people who tortured people in the concentration camps that were set up, who ran these concentration camps, people who murdered people, you know, who were there. They are old now, but there has been absolutely no attempt to hold them to account for this. And we know that the British actually took out in 1963, just prior to independence, they stole a huge cache of documents, not just from Kenya, but from their colonies around the world, you know, in an attempt to actually hide the fact that these atrocities happened.
This is why Nuruddin Haji, Kenya's director of public prosecutions, says the government would request extradition of troops involved in the murder to face charges in Kenya.
It's going on well. I think you saw on Friday, the DCI met with the British officials, and we have agreed on the best way to move. The court had, in the inquest, indicated that we proceed with the case, and after compilation by the DCI, we will be ready to proceed accordingly.
We asked Mr. Gadara to give us his final thoughts on what it will take to solve the Agnes Wanjiru murder file.
Well, there's a number of things I think are required to be done. The first is there has to be a serious, thorough, unfettered investigation of what happened in the case of Agnes Wanjiru, and a full-bodied prosecution here in Kenya, you know, of the soldiers. I think we need to get away from the impression that's created right now of this sort of anonymous soldiers. They need to be named, we need to know who they are, and we need to see that no, using the phrase that they like using, that no stone is left unturned in pushing for accountability for it. But beyond that, I think there needs to be serious discussions about why it is we have these soldiers from the British still active here in Kenya, why are they doing trainings here, and what are the safeguards, any, for local people so that we don't see this happen again.
Well, thanks, Mr. Gadara, Kenyan writer and cartoonist. Unfortunately, our time is up for today. Here at Africa Today, we shall continue following up the case of Agnes Wanjiru as the family seeks prosecution of British troops involved in this gruesome murder. We now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall focus on how most of Africa's stolen art is still stashed in Western countries, despite exaggerated reports of the return of some of the looted artifacts. Stay with us.
Stolen African art stashed in Western museums.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The French government has returned some 26 artworks it looted from Benin. Now, this is just a fraction of thousands of items stolen by France in the 19th century from Benin, including from its palaces of Abomey. now a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Some of these artifacts were stolen by colonial administrators, troops or doctors, and passed down to descendants. Many of these looted artifacts are still in private collections, but hundreds of thousands are kept in museums across Europe and North America.
Speaking in Paris during the signing of an agreement to bring back the stolen art, Benin's president said the return of the 26 pieces is just a first step.
We hope that the restitution of these 26 works of art is just a first step in the ambitious process of restituting heritage pieces.
Now for more on the struggle for return of all looted African artifacts stashed in European and North American museums, my colleague contacted Joseph Ochieno, a writer and African affairs analyst. Now we first asked Mr. Ochieno his take on why Western countries are suddenly returning some of the cultural heritage items they looted in Africa.
This is a very important question, and I think it's the case that credit to media agencies like yourselves, credit to the campaigns by various African communities, organizations, and indeed a few progressive Western academic institutions, that following slavery and beyond slavery, it's time that now Africa should be able to have what belongs to it. The cultural artifacts were, like, if you like, amongst those things that very much determined the realities and the backbone of our civilizations. And they were looted and stolen. And of course, these are prized items that directly relate and link with the African communities. But beyond that, I think it is also the case that as the world moves on, a much more younger generation of Western citizenry and indeed scholars becoming part of the campaign for fairness and global justice, and that must therefore really include questions of artifacts or whatever other material items will have been looted from either Africa or any of the rest of the other worlds that were by and large colonized by Western power.
According to some estimates, the Quai Branly Museum in Paris alone holds some 70,000 African objects, yet Mehran handed over only 26 artifacts to Benin amid a media circus. A curator from a museum in Benin speaks before the return of the looted artifacts in this Paris museum.
These art pieces are of essential importance for Benin. It has been more than a century that these pieces have been removed from their historical context. These artifacts returning to the country today is just historical for the people of Benin.
Now, considering the high number of looted African artifacts being held in Western museums, is this highly publicized return of just a few of the looted items meant to hoodwink the public?
It was purely that, hoodwink, and I think it's scandalous, isn't it? Because up to 90% or thereabouts of precious African artifacts are held in either Western museum or libraries. So I think this is one of the things that needs to be done, and that is that African governments, African advocacy groups, and indeed global organizations, including news media like Press TV as we talk today, should double their efforts in making sure that these loots are actually returned not only to Africa, but respective African communities. This is direct theft that took place hundreds of years ago, but it's the direct theft that now that has been established that who stole and where these items should be returned to the owners.
The president of Benin, Patrice Talon, made it clear that the handover was the first step in a large-scale restitution process. We asked Mr. Ochieno if there is any legal or political mechanism to compel European colonial powers to return all the artifacts they stole from Africa.
I think there would be a very important legal case. This must be a really important legal basis on which, as I said, the principle of property and ownership, that if these are items that were taken from Africans by force and against the wills of many Africans, in many cases brutalizing and killing the owners of these items, there's no reason why a legal test case is not put in place, number one. But number two, the Africans continue to advocate for reparations, including for and around slavery. I would be one of those people who would join part of that campaign and make sure that this is actually enhanced. That is both legally and indeed politically. But beyond that, I think African governments today should have the ability and the capacity to demand that these items are actually returned, and so are African academic institutions. So those are political pressures. But beyond that, I think African civil society organizations, and indeed possibly young African academicians, can actually opt to boycott some of the institutions that hold these items. That is to put pressure. Finally, I think global agencies that are like the United Nations should surely be the space where these conversations should be able to take place, and to compel Western governments to return what really is not theirs and what is really, really African.
26 works of art stolen by France returned to Benin on the 10th of November. This was a landmark in the long fight by African countries to recover looted artifacts. A member of one of Benin's royal families believes the return is important for young people in the country.
I think the youth should take a keen interest in the museum that will be built. Because I think the youth is a bit lost in terms of tradition.
Are the masses in Africa, especially the youth, aware of the continent's artifacts looted by Western countries during the colonial period?
Part of the challenge is that many Africans possibly don't even know the fact that this kind of act does exist. Many of the African governments continue today, in many cases, to work and relate with many of these Western organizations, and so therefore calm down their citizens. But beyond that, going forward, as I say, you know, these are opportunities for tourism. These are opportunities for reclaiming our civilization. And thanks to programs like yourself, these matters and subjects must be on the national table. But guess what? While I know this through my research, campaigns, and advocacy, I'm not quite sure how many nation states' televisions had these subjects that hit the headlines. Think about South Africa, the possibly the most established in terms of academia and universities and institutions of learning and research. In South Africa, I doubt. In Egypt, I doubt. In big Nigeria, I doubt. In Kenya, I doubt. So that tells you very, very few mainstream media organizations on the continent, whether state or perhaps private, would necessarily have covered this. So your guess is as well as mine. How are these things and these matters going to reach the conversational tables of average African citizenry?
Despite the return of the looted artifacts being a drop in the ocean, the people of Benin are jubilant and hopeful that this will be the start of full restitution.
Today we're so happy about what's happening in our country. We're so happy. What we've been looking for, it's for our artwork to come back to us.
Finally, we asked Mr. Ocheno, what is the significance of the restitution of stolen artifacts to the African people?
Really, so that we can begin to have conversations to heal the past and begin to move forward. And there is no other better way of healing the past than merely returning what is purely African. Because one of the things, and a good case would be made, both politically and legally, that not only is it the return of these items good enough, but imagine you borrowing, getting a loan, even if it's only 1% per annum, and is for over 130 or 150 years, how much would it be? So no, I think it's in the best interest of Western governments and these institutions to return our stuff under whatever circumstances. But going forward, I hope Africans will join part of this conversation debate and demand for the return of these items, all of it really, but also make sure that in the event that there is a difficulty in returning, we make it as much a political case and a political question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Ocheno. There you have it. He says African people must insist on the return of all artifacts looted by Western countries during the era of colonialism. On that note, we come to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It was great having you. Goodbye for now, and God bless you.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The role of outstanding people in helping the country reach the front lines of global science. This is a part of the speech delivered on November 17, 2021, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a number of the academic elite and top scientific talents of the country. Another point about the academic elite is that scientific personalities, as our discussion is about scientific personalities, must look to the future, the horizon drawn for science in the country, and pay attention to this. I have said before that we should move in such a way that in a reasonable period of time, a few years ago, I spoke of 50 years, Iran will be a source of science in the world. In other words, if people want to know about the latest scientific findings, they will have to learn Farsi. This is possible to happen in the future. You should not be surprised at this. It was like this one day in the world. Once, at a point in history, our scientists were at the pinnacle of knowledge in the world. Their books received careful attention and were cited in all the universities of the world. In the universities of the West and the East, India, China and the like, which were also centers of knowledge at that time. We must look to this horizon.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
A depiction of the stages for reaching the pinnacle of science in the world. Of course, there are certain stages needed for this. The first stage is to bridge the gap between us and other countries in terms of science. We have a large gap to fill. Of course, we admire the scientific progress we have made, as our statistics, which are based on global statistics, prove. This scientific progress is commendable, and we have truly made progress. However, we are far from being on the front lines of science in the world, and this is due to the fact that they have kept us behind for 200 years. After the victory of the revolution, a movement took place, and starting about two decades ago, a faster movement began. We have made good progress, but we are still a long way off. The first step is to fill this gap. The second step is to progress past the borders of world knowledge. In other words, we should be able to offer new scientific aids and new scientific discoveries to the world. I will expand on this later, and the next step after this is to pursue a new Islamic civilization.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The President of the Shura Council and the Deputy Speaker of the House of Representatives in the Saudi-backed Hadi regime admitted that the regime has turned its back to Yemeni people and accused the Saudi-led coalition of causing a humanitarian crisis for the whole nation.
The statements by the officials in the Hadi regime clearly show that the war is not the solution to the current problem in Yemen and the country needs a political solution. The statements also reveal the constructive role of the Ansarullah group in the fight against the Saudi-led coalition. There is a growing public call for an end to the war in Yemen.
The Deputy Minister of Information in Sana'a, Nasruddin Amir, said these statements came in the right direction, and Sana'a encourages taking such stances against the Saudi-led coalition, even if they do not have a direct impact on the battle.
We welcome any protests within the Saudi-led coalition. These protests show the true nature of the coalition and come in the right direction. We know that this is the U.S. who is leading the war on Yemen.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen on March 2015 to return their protege, exiled former President Abdurrabbu Mansur Hadi, to power. The war has killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children, and pushed the country to the brink of famine.
For 7 years now, Saudi Arabia has failed to achieve any of its announced goals in the beginning of the war. Observers say Riyadh should start looking for other means, including a political solution, to get rid of the quagmire it's stuck with its war on Yemen, since the Yemeni army has proven that it is now a real threat to the kingdom more than ever. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
As the winter draws near, relief materials starts pouring in for destitute Rohingya refugees in India. But urge for schooling and educational material for their children is their biggest worry. Despite the UN conventions on the rights of child, irrespective of nationality, faith or ethnicity, the majority of Rohingya children continue to be deprived of any formal education, therefore threatening their future.
We have faced all the odds and miseries of this world, but we appeal to the world community not to ignore our generations and do everything possible to help us educate our children.
Several thousand Rohingya Muslims have been camping in parts of India for more than a decade, with nothing more to share rather than horrid tales of violent past. In almost all refugee camps, children would usually be seen spending time in dirt and filth, raising fears of disease and infections across the camps. Nevertheless, nobody cares, including them. This man says anxiously, "We will fight with life as long as we can, but the future worry of our children might kill us silently."
We have been living here in peace since the last 9 years, never faced any troubles. But now things look very challenging. India gave us hope of new life. We want to stay alive for our children, lest we have no hope left.
Regardless of refugee crisis the world has witnessed since last decade, this particular community continues to be unseen victims of violence, yet ignored or perhaps abandoned. Estimates suggest more than 40,000 Rohingya refugees live in India after fleeing a brutal crackdown in Myanmar. The UN refugee agency responsible to support them is of insignificant help, they say. Rights activists have time and again appealed to the Indian government to lend all possible support to the community, despite the fact they face threat to life back in Myanmar. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh, but it never endorsed any framework to safeguard the interests of these refugees. Now calls are growing for concrete refugee policy, irrespective of political agenda, faith, or ethnicity.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin met with South Korean Minister of Defense Suk Thursday. The two counterparts agreed to develop new operational plans to deal with what Austin described as North Korea's destabilizing behavior.
The United States and the ROK remain committed to a diplomatic approach to the DPRK, and we continue to call upon the DPRK to engage in dialogue. But we also discuss measures to enhance our combined deterrence posture and to defend against the full range of threats.
Missile and nuclear programs. South Korea wants to see sanctions suspended and an official declaration to end the Korean War, two items apparently not near the top of the military chief's agenda. Meanwhile, outside South Korea's Ministry of National Defense, activists called for Seoul to disentangle itself from an alliance with the U.S. and take control of its own national defense.
South Korean armed forces and military resources are likely to be dragged into U.S. Indo-Pacific strategies. We came here to denounce it and to deliver this message to the American authorities. The U.S. should return wartime operational control immediately.
Austin also called out China over its military buildup, as Washington now plans to move more forces, an attack helicopter squadron, and an artillery division headquarters to be stationed in South Korea. The meeting here between the leaders of the U.S. and the South Korean militaries comes following the release of the Pentagon's 2021 Global Posture Review. The U.S. will now place even more emphasis on deterring China and North Korea, with Washington calling for more help from its allies. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In draft documents presented to the signatories of the nuclear agreement, Iran is calling for the removal of all U.S. sanctions that violate the deal signed in 2015, known officially as the JCPOA. Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister and lead negotiator Ali Bagheri-Kani says the Iranian draft includes calls for the removal of all sanctions, especially those imposed under former President Donald Trump, as part of the U.S. maximum pressure campaign.
One of the fundamental issues is that no sanctions that violate the agreements, including those imposed under the Obama, Trump, or Biden administrations, should stay. They're not acceptable. Some of this hadn't been considered in the previous draft. We've included our modifications.
Iran has called for the verifiable removal of sanctions